Hello, and welcome to Smithsonian, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Smithsonian Magazine here on Owl Radio. And today's articles come from the October 2022 edition. As I've reminded people before, this magazine, which is such a treasure and echoes, mirrors all the multiple museums that are involved or part of the Smithsonian Institute, covers agriculture, history, geography, ecology, pop culture, justice issues, sports, all kinds of things. And today we are going to have some articles about several different topics or categories of those. Well, the first one is entitled Flying High. The National Air and Space Museum reopens to the public, transforming the way we tell the story of aviation. And this is written by the Secretary of Smithsonian Magazine, Lonnie G. Bunch III. And this really caught my eye because every single time that I would take my children, my sons, to Washington, my parents lived not far from D.C. in Northern Virginia, and I would take them across from their grandparents' house to the Smithsonian. The Air and Space Museum was one of their favorites, but that was many, many years ago now, and they had closed it for an extended period of time for renovation and revitalization. It would be fascinating to see what it would be like today. Well, this is how Mr. Bunch describes it. To slip the surly bonds of Earth, as World War II aviator and poet John Gillespie McGee Jr. famously described it, is a freedom long aspired to by humankind, uniquely capturing our imagination. One of my favorite displays at the National Air and Space Museum, where I began my Smithsonian career, has always been the Wright Flyer. The humble aircraft and its improbable flight still spark the boyhood wonder I felt about seeing it years ago. On October 14, the west end of the museum reopens to the public, allowing imagination to again take flight. The museum's unparalleled collections of important aeronautic artifacts will still be familiar, but its redesigned wing, containing 8 new exhibitions, part of an ongoing renovation, will also transform the way we tell the story of flight. 40% of the new gallery's artifacts will be on display there for the first time. Its new objects, stories, and experiences featuring historical aviation accomplishments and contemporary aerospace events will inspire the next generation of innovators and explorers. Just as importantly, they will reveal a deeper, more expansive aerospace history, telling stories that have often been overlooked. For instance, take Neil V. Loving, the aviation pioneer who helped create an all-black civil air patrol squadron during World War II to train pilots. After he lost both legs in a glider crash, he continued to design, build, and fly his own airplanes, becoming the first African American to earn a Professional Race Pilots Association license to race airplanes. His Loving WR-3, a 2-seat aircraft with foldable wings to allow it to be towed by car, will be featured in the redesigned galleries. Of course, aviation has not only transformed the way we travel, it has changed the way we see the world and inspired everything from art to literature. When filmmaker George Lucas was making the first Star Wars movie, he used footage of World War II and I and II aerial dogfights to show the special effects team what he wanted the action to look like. Visitors to the reopened museum will be able to see an X-wing starfighter used in Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker, its wings spanning 32 feet, on loan from Lucasfilm. From the first tentative 120-foot flight of the Wrights aircraft to the Apollo 11 command module Columbia that traveled a total of 953,054 miles on its moon voyage, the National Air and Space Museum embodies our innate desire to learn, to experiment, and to explore. It also shows that a belief in making the impossible possible is no flight of fancy. And that is from Mr. Bunch, who's the secretary of the Smithsonian Magazine. Well, did I mention that it sometimes covers music in this magazine? That is the category of our next article. This is by Jeannie Rice, All That Jazz, the plucky institution that staged a brassy comeback for America's signature music. The seats are simple benches. The space is small. To stand at the back of the hall is to be only 20 or so feet from the band. The wooden walls are washed out. Even the instruments used by the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, founded with the hall in 1961, feel a bit old. It's been a while since clarinets and tubas were central to popular music. And then, of course, there's the traditional repertoire, comprising standards that reach back to the first decades of the 20th century, like Little Liza Jane and St. James Infirmary. Unlike other famous jazz venues that have changed their decor and ethos with the times, Preservation Hall remains the most authentic, with a pure emphasis on the music. In some ways, the antiquity of the scene is the point. It feels like going back in time. The hall, which didn't even have air conditioning until 2019, has persisted against steep odds, much like the city of New Orleans. And at the time of the hall's founding, New Orleans jazz was in need of preservation. Traditional jazz had enjoyed a resurgence in the 1940s, but just a decade later, rhythm and blues, bebop, and rock and roll were dominating American airwaves and venues, and traditional jazz halls closed around the city. To some degree, these hot new genres of popular music were largely drawn from the traditional jazz that had been born in New Orleans. Joel Dinerstein, a professor of English at Tulane University and author of the 2020 book Jazz, A Quick Immersion, says these new forms of pop were, in fact, different idioms of jazz. Yet, despite having provided the roots of this new music, jazz itself was taking a back seat. Recognizing the need to keep traditional jazz alive, New Orleans art dealer Larry Borenstein invited his favorite musicians to rehearse in the garden of his gallery in the French Quarter. A crowd started to form, and over time, people from around the world visited what was then called the New Orleans Society for the Preservation of Traditional Jazz, where they heard the greats of the 20th century, including George Lewis, Punch Miller, Sweet Emma Barrett, and the Humphrey Brothers. Around the same time, in Philadelphia, a young couple named Alan and Sandra Jaffe were falling in love with jazz. Returning from a honeymoon in Mexico, they stopped in New Orleans in 1961. They decided to stick around. That same year, Borenstein handed his performance space over to the Jaffes, who rented the gallery at 726 St. Peter Street for $400 a month and moved the music inside. The venue soon became known as Preservation Hall. Alan managed the artists and occasionally picked up his sousaphone and played with the band. Sandra assisted her husband with the books and worked the door. Trained as a journalist, Sandra helped advertise the bands and organized a weekly schedule. Originally, the shows were free with a request that visitors make a donation, but eventually the pair started charging a dollar to hear the music. Still, the hall wasn't profitable until at least a decade into their ownership. In 1963, the Jaffees created a touring ensemble to spread the traditional jazz that was enjoying a renaissance in New Orleans. The band's first tour through the Midwest was a success, and by the end of the year, the Preservation Hall Jazz Band was playing to fans around the globe. The group has performed everywhere from Fillmore West in San Francisco to Thailand's Royal Palace. New Orleans police cited the Jaffees more than once for providing a space for mixed crowds in violation of the city's segregation laws. After Sandra got arrested one day, according to her son Ben, the judge said, "In New Orleans, we don't like to mix our coffee and cream," Ben says. Sandra burst out laughing and said, "That's funny. The most popular thing in New Orleans is Café au lait." While rejuvenating the city's jazz scene, the Jaffees also materially improved the lives of the artists who performed in their space. A lot of the musicians were older and they didn't have any money, Dinerstein said. Some of them were ill, and they were revived by this. They were all great musicians. Alan Jaffee died in 1987. A few years later, Sandra moved to Florida, and Ben, their son, took over the family business. But she visited New Orleans often. Each time, she stopped at Preservation Hall before even going to her hotel. She would stand in the carriageway and listen to the band's play, says Ron Rona, the hall's current artistic director. Today, the Preservation Hall Jazz Band still travels the world as a rotating collective of more than 60 musicians led by Ben Jaffee, a fine tubist and bassist in his own right. In recent decades, the band has broadened its audience through collaboration with pop artists like Tom Waits, Annie DeFranco, and Arcade Fire. And though the band plays many of the same tunes as the original lineup in the 1960s, Rona says the word preservation can be misleading. "Jazz is an evolution," he says. "The melodies might be the same, the forms might be the same, but the musicians put themselves into it. In that sense," he says, "these are brand new tunes." So there is an interesting piece of history of music, in this case, jazz. Our next article is in the category, as they have called it, of innovation. This is written by Danny Friedman, and it's entitled "Paper Trail: Unearthing the Long-Lost Secrets of the Country's Earliest Inventions." The fire bled upward from the cellar and swelled to an inferno overnight. Buckets and hoses proved no match for the blaze. A horrified crowd assembled outside Blodgett's Hotel, where the U.S. Patent Office shared space with the Post Office, and the sun rose on December 15, 1836, to find the entirety of the nation's intellectual property records turned to ash, around 10,000 patents in total. Every invention registered with the government since 1790. Wow. So 46 years worth of paperwork about inventions. After the fire, the Patent Office, now the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, implored inventors to send in their original documentation to be duplicated. That effort formally ended in 1847, and to this day, only around 2,800 of the lost patents have been fully replicated in the agency's records. But the USPTO has revived the rescue program, and it's going brilliantly. Most notable among the recent discoveries are two, authenticated this summer, belonging to 19th century steamboat magnate Robert Fulton. The papers, dating from 1809 and 1811, are Fulton's own signed original copies of the patents. These were crucial in helping Fulton protect and expand the country's first commercially successful steamboat enterprise, which he founded in 1807. The two patents are housed at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis, Maryland. Alex Rowland, a retired Duke University history professor who is writing a Fulton biography, and St. John Courtney III, a patent judge whom Rowland met in the course of his research, brought the patents to the USPTO's attention. These two finds represent iconic ex-patents, says Adam Bisnow, who became the agency's first official historian in 2020 and went on to formalize and expand the recovery initiative. Many of the records destroyed in 1836 are known as ex-patents. They predated the patent numbering system and were retroactively assigned numbers appended with an X. The Fultons are now known as 995X and 1434X. Bisnow believes more ex-patents could be similarly hidden in plain sight in public and private collections. They might even be framed on people's walls just as examples of Americana. Collectors needn't worry about surrendering a treasure, though. Patent officials need only a high-resolution facsimile of an authentic document. Bisnow hopes these two Fulton finds will stir the interest and the help of the many caretakers of the nation's paper trails. Archivists tend to know the value of what we have, he says. They've been waiting for somebody to come looking for it. So that is an interesting endeavor that the Patent and Trademark Office is undertaking to try to replicate all of those patents that were, oh, goodness, 40 years worth in some of the earliest days of our country. Very interesting effort. Well, the next article is in the category of justice. And it is written by Martin J. Kernan, The Drive for Equality, How Florence St. John and Her Co-Workers at General Motors Set the Precedent for Equal Pay Back in the 1930s. By 1938, there wasn't a job Florence St. John hadn't done in the raucous sheet metal department at the Olds Motor Works in Lansing, Michigan, where around 300 workers at 70 or so behemoth machines punched, drilled, welded, and riveted Oldsmobile parts. St. John stepped onto the factory floor for the first time in 1928, joining around 30 other women in the overwhelmingly male trade. The 32-year-old mother of three worked elbow to elbow with the men, levering heavy presses to bend and cut steel. In the 1930s, managers at the Olds Motor Works, a division of General Motors, treated St. John and the other women the same as men in nearly all but one respect, pay. St. John first discovered a pay disparity during games of check pool, a form of poker that the workers played with their paychecks to entertain themselves on the factory floor. Time after time, St. John and the other women noticed a pattern. Men on the same shifts with similar jobs and less seniority, some of whom the women had trained, appeared to be making more. This curious game of chance would eventually tip the scales at trial and result in the first major damages award in a job discrimination case in U.S. history. A critical but largely forgotten struggle that inspired women and legislatures across the country to take up the cause of equal pay. Lower pay didn't mean lighter loads for the women, whom, among other duties, had to drag around huge pans full of car parts weighing up to 200 pounds, often without assistance. If they didn't meet strictly enforced quotas, the men and women knew they would lose their jobs. In the heavy press room, St. John worked with women, including her friend Moretta Cobb, and men, as the workers wrenched together strips of steel to make an elaborate part called a harmonic balancer, a sturdy 5-pound disc that absorbs vibrations that would otherwise damage the engine. In assembling the balancers, the women were themselves equal to men in strength, skill, and grit, as attested by their male co-workers. There was a sense they were all in it together. Checkpool eroded this sense by revealing that GM paid men $15 to $20 more per pay period. In late 1936, as strikes erupted at GM plants in nearby Flint, Michigan, in response to poor working conditions and hundreds of worker deaths, St. John began urging Forrest Brown, her co-worker and a union rep, to help the women close the pay gap. Brown repeatedly confronted GM managers with an obscure criminal law, Michigan Penal Code number 328, section 556, that made it a misdemeanor to, quote, discriminate in any way in the payment of wages as between sexes. But GM wouldn't budge, with one manager telling Brown if it were up to him, he wouldn't have any women working in his department. When Brown took a position with the Michigan Department of Labor and Industry the following year, he investigated the Olds Motor Works for violation of the statute. By then, GM, in an attempt to comply with the statute, had parked St. John and others in a newly created women's division, where they ostensibly did lower-skilled work like sorting bolts, but where they still found themselves bound to do more intensive jobs, such as making harmonic balancers. Most of the women bridled at the segregated arrangement and the continued low pay, 76 cents an hour to a comparably skilled man's 97 cents. And many women quit. For reasons that aren't clear, Brown dropped the investigation. At trial, St. John recalled the moment as a crucial turning point in rallying her fellow workers at meetings in their homes. And in March 1938, they decided, as St. John put it, to see Mr. Pierce, that is, Barnard Pierce, a prominent civic-minded Lansing lawyer. Pierce and his partner, Joseph Plank, had made headlines in the local papers as successful trial lawyers, but weren't known as civil rights specialists. Nonetheless, the pair devised a legal maneuver to transfer 28 other women's claims to St. John, then filed a lawsuit that prefigured modern class actions. Thus, on April 7, 1938, St. John took the unprecedented step of suing GM on her own behalf and that of her women co-workers for back pay. Never, it appears, has any group of women banded together in this fashion and demanded damages for lost wages. GM answered by preemptively attacking the constitutionality of the Michigan law upon which St. John's case now hinged. An ensuing 3-year legal battle culminated in the decision by the Michigan Supreme Court to uphold the 20-year-old statute, which no one had ever sought to enforce before then. Having ruled that St. John and the company had standing for their suit, the High Court sent the case to the Ingham County Circuit Court for trial, where the burden was on St. John to prove there was a pay disparity. The trial began on June 2, 1941, before Judge Charles Hayden in an ornate courtroom that today still occupies the third floor of the Ingham County Courthouse in the town of Mason, just outside Lansing. The women girded themselves for a trial that would consume 6 oppressively hot weeks, see some 70 witnesses testify, and receive in evidence more than 10,000 exhibits. Beginning with St. John, the women told of their pay history as compared with the men's, of men and women side by side doing the same heavy and technically demanding work, of the cooperative atmosphere on the production floor. St. John and Moretta Cobb told the judge how they had to do their heavy assembly work at unimaginable speed, cranking out one harmonic balancer about every 30 seconds to meet their quota of up to 105 an hour. It was one of the heavier operations, their foreman admitted at the trial, referring to the harmonic balancers, an admission that undermined GM's claim that women did only lighter work, thus meriting lower pay. As the days wore on, the women watched numerous GM foremen and managers testify that men were more versatile, stronger, able to work longer and at night, easier to train and more mechanically inclined. The managers said St. John and other women had complained about the difficulty of their jobs, that foremen had ordered women not to lift heavy loads, that the company had hired men whose only job was to help the women. The women even had a hot plate in a break room, the managers protested, which GM had reluctantly allowed the women to use after St. John had smuggled it in. Finally, Plank convinced Judge Hayden to make GM cough up payroll records, initially withheld, to protect GM's right against self-incrimination. Court was delayed a half hour while the cartons of time and rate cards, canceled checks, and other pertinent material were carried up three flights of stairs. The proof of pay discrimination was thus laid bare on counsel's table. Judge Hayden found for the plaintiffs, and on May 29, 1942, the case made national news. 29 women win $55,690 in wage equality ruling, the New York Times announced. 3 years of GM appeals later, January 1945, the women were awarded $55,690, close to $1 million in today's money. By then, the plant had been refitted for war production, and equal pay for women at America's wartime factories had been the rule since 1942. That groundbreaking feat was made possible by Mary Elizabeth Pidgeon and Mary Anderson of the Department of Labor's Women's Bureau in Washington, D.C., who used St. John's court victory to convince the War Labor Board to equalize pay rates between men and women, which it did on November 24th of that year. There were some other women instrumental in forwarding this law, and one is Mary Van Cleek, a tenacious researcher. She published a groundbreaking report in 1918 that laid bare women's overlong underpaid hours. It was later adopted into the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act, which established a federal minimum wage and a standard work week and outlawed child labor. And Freda Miller, who was director of the U.S. Women's Bureau from 1944 to 1953, she saw that many women wanted to keep working when men came home from World War II, and she helped them realize that dream. As a result, while 3.25 million women did lose their jobs at the end of the war, 2.75 million found new work. These are all the change makers at the Women's Bureau in D.C., who helped expand rights for millions of women. So an interesting progression that sometimes still has echoes today of fair pay. Well, you have been listening to Smithsonian Magazine on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. It was quite a variety of topics that we covered today. There will be more next time. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.